Session number 9590, Reel 2.
Mr. Duffield, Reel 2.
Over into the Baltic Sea, and then approach to Lübeck, and then turn from Lübeck to direct our attention towards Berlin. So on the second night, we did exactly the same thing, with the same number of aircraft, 200 aircraft. But this time, as they knew, they'd worked out what we're doing, we were met with rather more fighter aircraft on the approach, and so some of the aircraft were engaged with them. And then when we got to Berlin, the cloud had covered Berlin by this time, and also the people that were dropping the markers had not made it to the target, so no markers appeared. And so we spent about 20 minutes circling over Berlin waiting to see the markers to bomb, and that's a long time to be in an area over a target. And in the meantime, of course, the searchlights were very active, and so was their anti-aircraft fire, and we were getting thumped about a lot by the anti-aircraft fire. And it's quite frightening, this sound of big cudgels bashing on the side of the aeroplane, which is what it sounds like to you, and you could see the flashes and the puffs in the sky ahead of you. In the end, after about 20 minutes, we saw a partial clearance, and I said to the pilot, well, I can see parts of the target down there, and I think that we ought to do something about it. And so he told the bomb aimer to take the mark and bomb at that point there. And so we bombed there. And as we did that, of course, then all the other aircraft charging around Berlin saw our bombs. Because the incendiaries, when they strike a target, make lines rather like tram lines of fire, you see. And then from then on it was intersected by all these bombs going off and the incendiaries lighting, and so they were bombing where we'd bombed, you know, in that area. So it wasn't, in point of fact, the intended target area, because we didn't know where that was because we had a light on the marker, but we could see we were bombing Berlin, so we were quite happy to do that, because Berlin was a target to us in any way we had thought, because we don't think I wouldn't think the same way as people would talk now when they talk long after the war, and they would say this was a terrible thing to do, just drop your bombs willy-nilly, as you might say. But in the wartime you wouldn't think in that way at all. I certainly wouldn't have done.
Why not?
Well, because you remember the war was a very personal thing to you. For instance, my own house had been damaged in air raids in Middlesbrough, and you've seen what the bombing went on in London and in all the city. I mean, I'd visited Coventry and Birmingham. I've been in Birmingham when they were bombing it, so I know what went on there. And so I was quite happy to bomb anywhere in Germany. I would chiefly did it. I've known many Germans since, and there's nothing wrong with Germans, by the way. They're quite nice people, but the wartime makes you think differently. They're just your enemy and you're going to kill them, regardless, isn't it? And I felt no compunction in these days. And so we just let our bombs go, and then at that, of course, so did the rest of the force. In the meantime, they were knocking the clappers out of us above it. And then just as we were leaving the area, and then we got a very bad burst of anti-aircraft fire, and this took off the Astrodome off the aircraft. It also struck the front forward position where the bomb aimer was, and in point of fact it wounded the bomb aimer. And this is flying officer McDonnell, Douglas, and he just called out that he was hit, and so the captain told me to go down to see to him, so I left my seat and called forward to find him, his face covered in blood, and so in the area of his eye. So I applied a dressing to his eye there, and then I decided I would drag him back from the front turret. So I dragged him out the front turret, and I dragged him back to the only warm bit of the aeroplane, which was at the wireless operator's position, so I dragged him back there to try in the endeavour to keep him warm. That's what we did. We wrapped him up there and settled him down there, because he just had to sit and wait till we could get back. And so then we left the area, and as we we came over the island of Bornholm in the Baltic, and we got engaged with anti-aircraft fire there again. But fortunately, I was looking down at the time, and I saw the gun flashes. And so we made a very rapid change of altitude, and by the time the shells burst, we weren't where they thought we would have been. And so we managed to avoid that and then fly home. We were not able to return to Elsham Wold because of the weather in England, and we finished up landing at Croft, which is near Darlington. Well, it's a civil airport now. It's the Teesside Airport now, what's the old Croft airfield. And we landed there, and we sent Douglas off in an ambulance. The aircraft had suffered a lot of damage. There was holes all over the aeroplane, and there's chunks out of the engine cowlings. It's amazing how we managed to keep on going. It done no significant damage to the operating part, but we were pepper potted, as you might say.
What was morale like when you got back?
Fine, yeah. When you always feel, when you return for successful in operation, you'd always feel elated in that you'd got back, and it would tend to disguise the fears you'd experienced when you were doing it.
When you heard in the briefing before the second raid that you were going to take the same route...
Well, I personally didn't think it was a very good idea, you know, but you couldn't argue about what your orders were. You know, like all military people, your orders are what you're given, because that's been decided at the command, and that's it, isn't it?
But did you discuss it with the rest of the crew?
Yes, I discussed it with the captain, and he felt the same as me. He said, you know, we just obey orders like anybody else, innit?
What approximately was the date of these two Berlin raids?
Let me see. It must have been at the beginning of February 43. I could tell from my logbook, of course, which I've got next door, unfortunately.
We can check it later.
Yeah.
So that was the most dangerous raid you felt, that second Berlin raid?
Yes, it's when it sort of... That was the first time it was sort of brought home to me that it was really a very hazardous occupation, trying to survive. I already knew from what went on in the squadron, because I lasted a month longer on the squadron than one would normally expect to do, because we'd run into the same problem with Squadron Leader Powell. Because when Squadron Leader Powell was doing a little exercise, he was really doing an experience trip for me. We'd flown down to Torquay, where he was courting a girl down there. She was a nurse, and when he'd been in hospital after his first crash, she'd been one of his nurses, and he was sort of engaged to her. I didn't know that then, but I knew he was courting her. And so what he asked me to do, he written a letter, and he'd tied it to a toilet roll, and he said, now I'll go and fly over Torquay, he says, and when we get there, he said, would you heave this letter out, see, over to town. So we approached Torquay from the sea, and we'd be about flying at about 50 foot over the sea, and we approached Torquay, and we flew, and we just whooped low over Torquay, and I slung this letter out. Well, what actually happened then is the police picked the letter up. And the next thing was the squadron leader was called to command to explain why he was low flying over Torquay. And we were grounded for a month as a crew.
As punishment?
Yeah. And also, of course, he received a reprimand for his problems, which was serious to him, because he was a regular officer, remember.
Was it much of a punishment to you?
Not to me, it wasn't. Because it meant we did all sorts of duties on the camp, you know. I'd have rather been flying, but we were not, you know, we were not allowed to. Because we'd done this low flying again, you see. That wasn't my idea this time, it was the squadron leaders. So, that's relevant to the fact that it extended my stay in the squadron, and I could see on the squadron the rapid change in personnel. Because you remember, Bomber Command got killed very quick, and so you'd be talking to people in the mess one night, and the next day they were not there. Because the crew vanished, didn't it?
What were the targets in Berlin? Do you remember?
Yes, there was factories in Berlin. And we were trying to, and the one we were trying to bomb was the big Siemens factory, a big electrical factory, was what the target. We had to go out the first night, but the second night, because we didn't, because we, it wasn't marked for us.
How accurate was bombing in those days in the early part of 43?
Well, it wasn't, as you know. The technical facilities for directing your bombs weren't the best thing in the world in those days, you know. And also the training of the bomb aimers and the crews in directing wasn't such a high standard as it became. And so there used to be a very wide spread of the bombs on a target. So even if you know, it went aimed at a factory, you didn't necessarily hit it. You may hit something surrounding it. I mean, but there again, we used to try very hard. I remember, you know, speaking of our crew personally, I know that on the operations to Essen, which were against the big Krupp's factories there, I know that our bombs landed on the factories because we had pictures of them. Because as the bombs went, we dropped a big photo flash, and this illuminated the area. And at the same time, the cameras would go after predetermined time to give you an automatic recording of your bomb strike. And so we knew our bombs had hit the Krupp's factories there. But there again, when we went to Lorient, we knew that the bombs had missed the target altogether and landed in the water adjacent to the submarine pens, which is what we were trying to bomb. I very much doubt if we'd hit them, we'd have done any harm to the submarine pens, because they were enormous constructions. We were not aware of that, of course. We thought they were ordinary concrete structures. But we missed them. And of course, the second night of Berlin, we were not hitting the intended target. But we were certainly hitting a lot of houses.
Did you know how inaccurate bombing was in those days?
No, I didn't know of I didn't know of the widespread of other crews' results. No. It was only after the war that I found that out. I probably found that out when I wasn't flying. After I returned from Italy, towards the end of the war, I'd seen some summaries of our efforts in Europe. In the, you know, these confidential intelligence summaries, and I'd seen some reference to it then, but I really became fully aware after the war.
Now, you've mentioned that in the Essen raids you were after the Krupp's factory.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more details about the two raids that you undertook over Essen?
Well, these were, you know, to go to Essen was a very short flight from England, you know, from Lincolnshire. It was only a 4-hour trip all round. You know? But Essen, of course, was a very heavily protected area. And there was no way of going to Essen and pretending you were going somewhere else. and it didn't matter if you did, whichever way you went, there was heavy support, both in the terms of fighters and in the terms of anti-aircraft fire. And the minute you approached anywhere near the Ruwery, you were then engaged by searchlights and by anti-aircraft guns. Some of them, of course, were light anti-aircraft guns and wouldn't be able to touch the land because we'd be above them. But at the same time as we were going, of course, there's other aircraft going, like the Wellingtons and the Halifaxes, which flew lower. And they'd be getting engaged by these light aircraft guns, which would engage aircraft to about 16,000 feet, where the Lancs could avoid that. Yeah. But once the heavy aircraft guns started, they could get up to where we were quite easily. And so we used to get a lot of that. And I remember my Aussie pilot, the one that got caught martial earlier on, he'd done some operations on Wellingtons. And he used to say that when he was in an operation, and as soon as he saw another aircraft get coned in the searchlights, he used to fly towards that aircraft, because all the guns were engaged on that aircraft and they didn't bother him. And I noticed, so did Squad Leader Pardo. Whenever he saw an aircraft coned, he would go that way and avoid the attention of the gunnery, because they'd direct all their attention to the aircraft.
And it worked, did it?
Yeah, that used to work for you. It was very unfortunate, the poor soul getting coned.
You haven't said much about German fighter opposition.
Well, on one of the Essen trips, when we were returning, we saw a sort of a glowing light behind us, and the rear gunner reported this, and so we changed course, and wherever we changed, this followed us, and this was actually a fighter trying to close with us. And then the gunner reported that it was getting closer, and so the pilot then put the aircraft in a screaming dive, and just look what happened. Well, there's a cloud bank below us, and we got into this cloud bank and did some rapid changes of course, and we lost this fighter which was after us. I can't quite understand actually what the glow was, the rear gunner saw, but he definitely saw this glow, whatever it was, because a fighter doesn't show any lights normally.
What was the date of the Essen raids approximately?
I'd have to look this up in the logbook for you later on to give you those dates. Yeah.
On bombing raids, what was there to stop an aircrew if they agreed with each other that to preserve their own lives, they were going to adopt tactics so that their only interest would be to preserve their lives rather than to do as much damage to the enemy? Would that be possible?
It would be possible. There's nothing to stop you doing that, apart from the normal discipline thing. If you had an officer in the crew, it'd be unlikely that you remember there was a difference between rankers and officers, very pronounced in the services in those days, isn't it? It wasn't later on, by the way. It'd be unlikely that the crew could get together to discuss such a thing. No way would you be able to, would an NCO try to talk to an officer on those terms, isn't it? If it was an all NCO crew, which is quite possible, then I would say there was a higher possibility of this. I know it happened, by the way. I know there was crews that would go and drop their bombs in the sea and come back on some claimed defect.
Was that with the NCO crews?
Yes.
So presumably they could do this because they were all in the same mess?
That's right, yeah. They could talk about it more freely with themselves, yeah. But I would personally have never seen the point in doing that. Because it was terrible. It'd be sort of like admitting to yourself, you know, as I said to you before, everybody's a coward, but nobody will ever admit it to themselves. And it would be like that to do that, wouldn't it? It'd be like admitting you were a coward.
But how can you be sure that that's what happened, that they had just dropped their bombs in the sea?
How can I be sure?
Yes.
I only know of this really from hearsay, from you know, later conversations with bomber crews, some of who told me later on that they had, in point of fact, been in crews themselves that had done it. And
details did they give about it?
Well, these were people who'd done a lot of operations, and the stress was building up on them, yeah. And they were being sent to a target which that night they personally felt they didn't feel like they would survive it, yeah. And so they got again decide they would sort of increase the chances of fire for themselves, and they did it. But the chaps I was talking to, this is, you know, after the war, they, having done it once, they didn't repeat it because they felt it was more trouble to them in their thoughts after they did that, what they'd gained from it, they felt. So they then continued in their normal role of getting on with the work. It could be very stressful to go out and risk getting killed, isn't it?
So you mean they felt a strong sense of shame after?
Yeah, shame and guilt, that's right.
Did they tell you later on in the war or after the war?
These were speaking to them after the war.
And which squadrons did they belong to?
Well, I can't recall now.
You talked about the differences between officers and men, the gulf,
yeah,
between them.
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, it was a gulf of class, really. The Air Force, when I joined the Air Force as a young man, always fostered the separation between ranks, that is, between serving airmen, NCOs and officers. There was always a difference. And the difference is the general ranks and the officers was a social thing, really. And so it was always fostered this wide difference. So the officers sort of stood apart from you as a class. As the war progressed, of course, this gradually weakened, because the war's a great leveller in such things, you know.
Did the people who weren't officers resent the privileges of the officers?
No, they didn't have any privileges, just because they fought the same war as you. I know they lived in a separate mess, but they didn't have any more in the way of lifestyle than you did. They just had this difference in sort of status, you know. No, I don't think so, because we took this natural.
Now, tell me, can you tell me more about the Lorient raid?
Mm, yes. Well, that was my last but one raid on Lorient. And so we flew down. Now, this is the raid where we actually swamped the ground defence. It was a very heavy raid, and it took it place in two waves. And there was one wave sent in, and they actually bombed the defensive edge where the anti-aircraft guns were. And by the time the main wave arrived, which I was on the main wave, they'd silenced the anti-aircraft weapons, so we met no anti-aircraft. There were fighters in the area. And point of fact, I saw a Lancaster blow up in front of us, which had been attacked by a fighter. And you could see it ahead of us, and you see it blow up, and you could see crew bail out. Hmm? I also saw two aircraft collide with each other, because remember, you're very concentrated over a small area. I saw two aircraft collide, and out of one aircraft I saw people leap out, but out of the other one, nothing. It just windmilled into the ground, you know. But as from our point of view, you know, it was just a very straightforward run into the target, and we had no anti-aircraft to worry about, and we were not engaged by any fighter, and just to run in and bomb, and then to think that the bomb ever missed it. I was mad at him, because we knew he'd miss it, even without the photograph.
Was it easier bombing in France than in Germany?
No, it was just the same normally, just this particular raid. We were able to concentrate a large number of aircraft in a very short time.
So it wasn't less dangerous to go to France?
Oh no, just the same.
Now, can you describe to me in detail the raid that you made on Milan in which you were shot down?
Yes. Well, because, you know, there's the large Fiat factory in Milan, and we were directed to there, right? And they were marking the targets for us, and they were also marking the way in for us. And what we had to do, we had to fly over France and then cross the Alps and then fly, and as we went over the Alps and got into Italy over the Alps, they were marking Lake Maggiore for us, so we could see the lake. And what they were doing were dropping markers into the forest at the side of Lake Maggiore, and this would, not only was it illuminating on its own accounts, but it was setting fire to some of the trees while it was on with it, you know. And so we could see this marker quite clearly, and then we had a heading from this marker to fly, and then we knew the time from the marker to when we'd be, if we flew that course, we'd get to Milan. And then they marked the target in Milan for us with a marker. Now, this is the green marker which the bomb aims his target at. Now, each bomb aimer sets his settings on his bomb sight, and they all aim at the same target. But the bombs are not going to land in the same place, because each bomb aimer sets slightly different settings to give the pattern of bombs to run across the target the way the planners want, yeah, to get the maximum amount of damage to it. And so we ran in onto the green marker and we dropped our bombs. Now, one of the duties of the engineer was when the bombs were dropped, and in those days, the main bomb was one big 4,000-pound bomb, which was the first of the big bombs. We called them a cookie. And we also carried 4,000 pounds of incendiaries on this raid, which was 8,000 pounds of bombs altogether. And the engineer had to go back to the bomb, above the bomb bay, and he had to make sure the big bomb went. Because if it didn't go when the bomb aimer pressed the button, you released it either electrically or mechanically from the back. You had to make sure it went, whatever you did. See, the bomb had gone, so you had to go back. Now, when I'd gone back on the previous raids, I'd just got out of my seat and I went back. But this night, the navigator said to me, "You want to take your parachute back with you, Jack?" And he was commissioned, the navigator, by the way, so I picked my parachute up, and I, you know, the chest type, and I took it back with me. And we bombed, and the bomb went off, and then I could watch the bomb fall, you see, from through the floor of the bomb bay, because I had the little cover up to where the bomb rack was, so I could see if I was going to, if I had to release the bomb or not. But I didn't have to, it just went, you know, and so did all the rest of them. And then we had to fly straight then and level for about a minute to get the photograph, because the flare went down, and then you ran out, and the photograph, so you kept straight and level. So we flew for a minute, and then we just were turning off, after we'd run the minute, we're turning off now just to clear away from the land. And all of a sudden, I heard this awful bloody battering noise. Now, what had actually happened, in point of fact, another aircraft had dropped its bomb load on us. And so the aircraft had run into a stream of incendiaries. So, you know, from one of our own aircraft. I don't know which target he thought he was bombing. This is what I mean. You know that people bomb the wrong places. Because we were a minute clear of the target, so he wasn't bombing the target. Huh? And we ran into this. And then all the engines stopped. They just stopped, you know? And then the aircraft started to twist around. And I heard the pilot say, "Well, we've had it." Yeah? And he said, "You'd better jump." Yeah? And so I had my parachute with this time. I was very lucky, you know. So I clipped it onto my chest and I made my way to the back door. And then I started to open the rear door. But I couldn't open the thing. It just wouldn't open. No way would that back door open. And so I thought, oh. And then the aircraft started to twist, you know. So I thought, well, I'd better brace myself somewhere. So I went and put my back against the bomb compartment on the fuselage floor and braced against there. And the aircraft was spinning like mad by this time. You know, I could argue, you sort of, you know, it's just stuck there with the force of the spin. And then all of a sudden the aircraft recovered and sort of the spinning stopped and leapt out. And then I looked up the fuselage and there the door had opened. All on its own. So I went across to the door. And as I went there, I just come up and somebody came up to my side, which was the made up a gunner. And so then I just waved to him and I jumped out. But as I jumped out, I noticed he hadn't got a parachute with him. So obviously he hadn't found it by then, and of course he never did find it because he got killed. If I'd have been quicker on the mark, I could have tried to take him with me. Whether he'd have made it, I don't know, you know, but I would have tried. But I was out before, as I saw that. I was just jumping, you know, as I saw it turn on, so he hadn't got nothing on his chest. And I found out later on, in fact, the reason why the thing leveled out, I found out from the navigator who was up the front with the pilot. The navigator ordered them out and the bomb aimer had jumped out. And then the pilot got out of his seat and went to jump out the forward hatch. And then he changed his mind. He come back and he climbed back in his seat. And he'd succeed in regaining control of the aircraft to give the rest of us time to get out. And then he did this, and that's how I got out. And that's how the navigator got out. And then, of course, obviously, he'd lost control because he was killed, the pilot. So, in other words, he swapped his life for two of us. Yeah.
What was it like bailing out?
Well, I'd never, ever jumped in a parachute before, nor since. But I knew what to do because you didn't even receive any instruction on jumping out of aeroplanes, by the way. You were just given a parachute. Hmm? At least nobody gave me any instruction. But however, when I'd been a boy at Holden, I'd been taught how to pack parachutes. So I knew all about parachutes, and I knew what the drill was. Yeah. And so as I jumped out, I just counted three to myself, and I pulled a thing. And the next minute, I was pulled up with this violent hold. Well, I hadn't. When you're supposed to adjust your harness very tightly for jumping out in parachutes, but what the air crew tend to do is adjust it so they were comfortable with it in the aeroplane. In other words, it was too loose for me. So when I jumped it, I thought I was going to die because the pain in my groin was something to be believed. You know, I was hung there and it was this pretty agonising pain.